Welcome to Divorce Talk, a podcast for people who are contemplating divorce, going through one, or would like to know everything about the divorce process. Each episode, you'll hear from Chicago divorce lawyers from Bierman LLP, one of the largest divorce and family law firms in the state of Illinois, speak on all things divorce, from child custody, divorce litigation, mediation, the collaborative process, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, the Bierman Divorce Lawyers.
I'm Sandra Napoli Diarco. This podcast is for anyone who is considering a divorce, going through a divorce, or would like to educate themselves on divorce. Each episode features top divorce lawyers from Bierman LLP and will cover topics related to all aspects of divorce from lawyers who have seen and experienced almost everything. On this episode, we're talking about marital misconduct and dissipation with James Pritikin and Candace Myers. So before we get started into the meat and potatoes and what everyone would like to know about, if we can just learn a little bit more about each of you so that our viewers know who they'll be listening.
Well, I don't want to bore anybody.
But no, never.
I've been practicing family law for quite a while, and I am a past president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, Illinois chapter. I also served by appointment of the Supreme Court to the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission as a hearing chair. I think that's enough for me.
All right, Candace.
I've been practicing for almost 15 years, exclusively family law. I enjoy it very much. I was educated at Indiana University and got my law degree in Columbus, Ohio. I live with my husband and two children, and I practice collaborative and mediation, as well as litigation.
All right, let's not waste any time and let's get right into it. So today's topic is marital misconduct and dissipation. Can you tell me a little bit about exactly how is marital misconduct defined?
It can be defined in many, many areas. I think normally we think of marital misconduct as adultery, and adultery is no longer recognized as a crime in Illinois, so our statute has eliminated adultery as a grounds for dissolution of the marriage. In addition to that, our statute now eliminates marital misconduct from any consideration in the distribution of the marital estate. It is still a factor in the issue of the allocation of parenting time.
And just to jump in, while it's not a factor when the courts consider allocating assets, marital misconduct can still be dealt with as far as emotional abuse and physical abuse, as far as allowing one spouse to be living in the marital residence or dealing with the Domestic Violence Act.
Well, it also factors into something we call dissipation.
What is that? Because a lot of lay people, including myself, does not understand what dissipation means. Sounds like a big fancy word.
Dissipation. So dissipation is the use of marital funds by one spouse solely during the irretrievable breakdown of the marriage.
So then how does what we used to call marital misconduct factor into the distribution of the marital estate?
Great question.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, let's assume that your spouse has a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And let's assume that there is an adulterous relationship taking place, and it takes place in various beautiful vacation spots like the Caribbean, Paris, Rome. And let's assume that your spouse takes his paramour to all of these places at his expense, showers her with beautiful gifts at the expense of the marital estate. So how does the marital estate get compensated for this marital misconduct? If we are able to determine what those expenses were and identify them, and if they are determined to be what we now call dissipation, they are added back into the marital estate, and then they are distributed equitably.
So, Candace, how do divorce lawyers go about identifying? Because a spouse may not learn of marital misconduct or adultery, maybe 2 years, 3 years. I just heard of a case pretty much the entire length of the marriage. How does one go back, or how do the lawyers figure out what that number is, and how do you figure that out?
So the statute does limit the time. It cannot be the entire length of the marriage if, in fact, a marriage is 25 years and a spouse should have known or knew about this extramarital relationship or spending. But the statute does define that it can be at least no longer than 5 years. So really, the sweet spot is no more than 5 years from the date of filing the petition for dissolution of marriage. And how do we go about it? You know, the first place that I look as a professional is bank accounts. Second place is credit card statements. I think credit cards show a great deal and tell a great story about spending, especially comparing them to credit card statements from before a spouse perceives the marriage was breaking down and comparing what the spending was like in one screenshot of time compared to the current screenshot of time. And when Jim and I were talking, another great place to look is passports. You see the stamps. If there are stamps from various countries during the irretrievable breakdown, that is a good place to start with wondering if a spouse is traveling outside of the marriage.
Jim, what about if a spouse has opened up a credit card on the side and it's not a joint credit card? How do you trace that?
Well, first of all, my experience is that parties going through the dissolution of the marriage generally identify with separate credit cards. So that's not unusual that there's going to be a credit card in one spouse's name and a credit card in another spouse's name. So when you say, how do we go about it? Well, we first of all have to determine whether or not there is a credit card.
Got it.
Okay. And that, quite frankly, comes under the rules of disclosure, because that spouse has an affirmative duty to disclose all credit cards, all bank accounts. So when we have the beginning of that information, it's a trail that we follow. And I look at text messages. I look at phone records, aside from credit card statements, aside from bank statements.
I look at social media.
Social media, absolutely great source.
I think that is a great source of following someone's travel, someone's relationship, whether a spouse says, well, I am traveling to New York City for business, and you can see a photo of the spouse and another person clearly dining out and enjoying themselves. That might not be for
business. That's interesting, because it triggers right into something that I always tell my clients when I'm working with a client. Are you engaged in these social activities? Stop. You're finished with Facebook. You're finished with Instagram. You're finished with Twitter. You no longer participate in any of that social media. It's over. Because all you're doing is creating a wonderful trail for your wife, for your husband's lawyer to follow.
And just to be clear, anything prior to that conversation can be used,
absolutely,
correct?
And is easily discoverable.
Yeah,
I mean, subpoenas serve wonderful, wonderful purposes. You serve a subpoena, you get big surprises when they come back.
It's true. Yeah. And when Jim was talking about credit card statements and exchanging credit card statements, we can get clued in that there are additional accounts by reviewing accounts and showing payments from a bank account to a credit card that wasn't disclosed. And we send a subpoena to that credit card company. We not only may find the account that we knew about, but there may be six other accounts that were not disclosed.
So then come ATM withdrawals, which is the clever way of saying, well, now I don't leave a trail because I'm using cash. And the answer to that is, if the ATM withdrawals are unusual, you cite them as a dissipation by the other side. And the burden shifts as to who has to prove what those funds were used for. And that creates an interesting dilemma for the other party, because, first of all, there probably aren't any records of how he spends that cash, because the last thing he wants is a receipt. So there are no records of that. And chances are, if you see unusual ATM withdrawals, they're going to be treated as dissipation and added back into the marital estate. And last but not least, it's interesting that we have that five-year period that we can only go back to. What happens is that generally during that five-year period, one or the other is keeping secret the relationship that he has with or her with that paramour. So they're not really thinking about any trail that they're establishing within that five-year period. So as you begin to do your discovery and you get back to year five, four, or even three, you begin to find lots of trails because they weren't really thinking about divorce at that time. And they weren't worried about what kind of a trail they're going to leave behind.
Interesting. So let's take some examples. Let's assume spouse is cheating. How does that play into the divorce? How does that play into the greater share of the marital estate? Do I get more? Do I get less? How does that play into all the different parts that fall into divorce?
You do not get a greater share of the marital estate because your spouse has been in an adulterous relationship. It only comes into play in terms of dividing the assets, and maybe a spouse has spent unnecessarily or outside of the marriage. It would be considered a pre-distribution, just like if the assets were divided, that spouse would have had the opportunity to use those assets as they wished, but they did it during the marriage. So it's considered a pre-distribution. As far as parenting goes, if a spouse is in an adulterous relationship, unless the spouse is exposing the children to an individual who's unsafe, it doesn't come into play with decision-making and parenting rights and responsibilities.
I said at the beginning of our little discussion that we're an equitable distribution state. And maybe I need to spend a moment defining what that is. With my clients, I always start out with the presumption that the marital estate is divided 50-50. And that's the way I begin to approach it. And then I add into it the elements of what might make it a disproportionate distribution of the marital estate. The prime example is one spouse's ability to recover assets after the divorce as opposed to the other party. It helps the judge decide maybe this one deserves a little bit more than that one. But equally as important is allowing the judge to learn a little bit about the history of the marriage and the character of the parties. Judges are human beings, and they're influenced by human activity. So if you can convince a judge that, I'll use for sake of the term, the husband has really violated the vows of his marriage, and he's really engaged in some pretty awful behavior and disrespectful behavior towards his spouse, and has really treated her poorly, maybe even physically abused her from time to time. Well, those aren't necessarily factors that should be introduced in terms of a disproportionate distribution. Those factors can't help but be persuasive. If a judge is on a borderline considering whether somebody's going to get 60 or 70% of the marital estate, that may just push it to the 70%. And that's where it becomes useful.
So let's talk about the actual divorce process. First of all, how long does it typically take?
Well, I get that question a lot. I think it depends. If one spouse may have taken some emotional time and some time to do some internal planning and some external financial planning, it may take the other spouse some time to get up to speed, both emotionally and financially. Many times that one spouse has more assets and more access to assets and income, and the other spouse may need time to with their attorney to get caught up. So that process takes a bit of time, and it makes a difference on how educated the parties come to the table and how willing they are to listen to what the law is and to get good advice that is practical, and whether they're willing to work together and within the bounds of the law and being creative and whatnot.
Well, there are two aspects to divorce. There's children and there's property. And there really are two distinctive parts of the divorce. With respect to children, our Supreme Court has a rule. It says all matters relating to children must be completed within 18 months. Okay?
Unless good cause is shown, which is flexible.
Could extend it, certainly. But generally speaking, the courts want the children issue resolved immediately. And in fact, we're pressured at the very beginning of the filing of a divorce case to introduce what's called an allocation judgment, which used to be custody. We no longer have custody in Illinois. We have allocation.
Okay, so it's a new word for the same.
It's a very, very, very fancy word for custody.
Okay.
It really doesn't change very much except the terminology, quite frankly.
It's allocating decision-making.
Yeah.
And decision-making was formerly called custody.
So I think most of us lawyers, when we get into a case, focus on the children issues initially, see if we can get those resolved. If you can get the children out of the divorce, then you're really talking about the dissolution of a business partnership, which is really what the rest of the marriage is. How much have you got invested? How much did I invest? What kind of return do I get on my investment when this partnership is dissolved? I would think generally you don't see divorces go much beyond 2 years. That's probably a good goal. That's probably on the long side. Although I will tell you, quite frankly, in 3 weeks, I'm going to trial on a case that was filed in the year 2014. So they do go extended. They do go over a period of time.
Okay. So 2014, we're in 2019. That's a long time to be going through a divorce and to be single. Talk to me about dating during the divorce process.
Well, it's not prohibited. I do get folks in here quite often who's asked me, am I allowed to date? And my answer is yes, you are allowed to date. You were allowed to date during the marriage. You're allowed to date after the marriage. Where I caution my clients is the spending and ensuring that the spending does not go egregiously outside of the marriage, because you could have a spouse coming in and making a claim for dissipation.
Well, that relates to why marriage or why divorce takes longer. Dating outside the marriage or getting into a relationship after you file for divorce usually creates a situation where one of the partners is angry. And that anger manifests itself by prolonging the dissolution process. So you go from what normally would be 1, 2, 3, you're not getting out this easy. It's going to be tough on you, and I'm going to make you suffer because you're making me suffer and you humiliated me. So that process then becomes dragged out. I told you I'm going to take a trial in April on a case that was filed in 2014. Personifies exactly that. There's so much anger involved and there's so much intent on punishing the spouse that money is no object, although it really is, and time is no object.
So how are assets? We may have talked about this, but if you are going over 2 years and one or two of the people are dating other people and they are spending, how is that calculated into the final settlement?
What I like to do is have a balance sheet. And I like to start a balance sheet right from the beginning, setting forth all of the assets that we know about and continuing to update and follow all of those assets, all of the liabilities, to make sure that you have a handle on what is coming in and out of the marriage. Because, you know, during the divorce process, you could have a job loss, you could have a significant increase in income, you could have health issues, and just ensuring that you keep track of what's coming and going from a balance sheet perspective, I think is a good tool to make sure that you have a handle on people who are going in two different directions, are not legally severed, but are living separate lives.
And again, it goes back to the issue of dissipation and the tracing of how funds are used to get that balance, that's all.
So I'm jumping a bit, but let's talk about child support. And if I'm dating someone, does it affect how much I receive from the other spouse if they are dating someone?
Not in Illinois anymore.
Okay.
I mean, child support now is a financial calculation that's made with software programs, which doesn't calculate or take into consideration the issue that you just addressed. It's some question of math.
Can you walk me through that? I know that's another podcast, but there may be viewers whose interest may have been piqued.
We are an income sharing jurisdiction now. Up until a couple of years ago, it was a percentage of a non-custodial parent's income that was determined to be child support. It is now income sharing. And we have a formula, which I'm not going to get into because it's really too complicated for us to talk about here. But we add in each of the spouse's income. We then have to measure the number of nights that the child spends in each parent's home. And that's part of the calculation that's fed into the process. And when we feed that into this computer-generated program, we get a number. And it's a number that either one spouse owes to the other for support.
And if a spouse is dating someone, if that individual pays for items, it does not adjust the child support. So if I have a client who comes in, and let's say for purposes of this conversation, is the father who has a higher income, and he asks me, what if my spouse has a boyfriend and the boyfriend earns a significant income and takes the children out to dinner and takes them on trips? Will my child support be adjusted because of that? And my answer is no. And I mean, do you have a different answer to that?
Your answer is no. But let me just add one thing. Although I said that we are a computerized child support, that's not wholly true, because the court has the discretion to go above or below those requirements under the statute, depending upon the circumstances, especially lifestyle. And that lifestyle may dictate that child support exceed the statutory amount. And this happens frequently too.
Right. If you give a judge a good reason or several good reasons to deviate from the guideline, I think judges are interested in hearing those arguments and want some details and want some reasons to be able to order outside of those guidelines. But they have to be given to the judge in a organized and well-reasoned way.
The best example is private school tuition. It may very well require the court to exceed guidelines in order to provide enough support for the children, as well as to defray the expenses of private school.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So getting back to dissipation, does one party have a burden over the other to prove dissipation?
So the person who is claiming that the other spouse dissipated marital assets has the burden to be within the 5 years or 3 years that they should have known about this alleged dissipation. You have notice requirements, and the notice must be given within 60 days before the trial or 30 days after discovery closes. And it has to be set out with specifics and with timeframes and specific instances. It cannot be, for instance, a notice that says, I believe that you dissipated $425,000 signed by the attorney. It must be with specific dates and specific instances. And then the burden shifts to the party who is trying to state that they didn't dissipate marital assets. And the burden shifts, and that person needs to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they did not commit dissipation.
So what is clear and convincing evidence?
That's a great question.
You know, you've heard of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, I have heard
that's
that.
That's not clear and convincing evidence.
Okay.
But clear and convincing evidence is one step down from beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm. So it's a very substantial, significant burden that's placed on the defendant or a person who is trying to prove that these funds were for a marital purpose. That $500-some-odd dinner that I had was not with my paramour. It was with a business associate I took out for dinner, which helped me generate income for this marriage to help support your lifestyle. That's a burden that shifts to him. And it's a tough burden.
Okay. So a hypothetical. What if my spouse has a gambling problem and isn't perhaps purposefully spending it on another person, rather gambling it away because of his or her gambling problem?
It's a perfect example of dissipation. But I'll go one better than that. And it was a personal experience I had with a friend who I traveled to Las Vegas with, who was going through a divorce. I was not representing him. And he was extremely emotionally disturbed about his divorce situation, and he began to gamble. but gamble in a very careless manner and with sums that were beyond his means to lose. And I said, what are you doing? And he said to me at the very end, I'd rather the casino have it than her. And he gambled away almost the entire marital estate. Okay. Is anticipation?
Sounds like it to me.
Does it?
Interesting.
Okay. However, it may not be considered dissipation. And there is an Illinois case that states that if the gambling, for instance, was the lifestyle of the marriage for decades and decades, the spouse went to the racetrack, played the lottery, went to Las Vegas. Is it dissipation when this sort of behavior they participated in together and went on for 20 years? May not be dissipation.
Oh, so if you lose, it's dissipation.
If you win, you want half of it.
It's part of the marital estate.
Yes.
Candace, what about plastic surgery? If one spouse decides to go to Jim's wife and get lots of plastic surgery done, how does that play into?
Well, I think that the art of our profession
is... You're talking about cosmetic, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, cosmetic.
Cosmetic. Part of our profession is, I could argue that both ways. If a actress got cosmetic surgery to perfect some imperfections with her body or her face, and it would arrive at a great role, is it dissipation? I don't know. Is it dissipation when a spouse goes to get cosmetic surgery with the intention of filing a petition for dissolution of marriage the next month? And dating and finding a new husband, then it's, in my opinion, it's considered dissipation.
I'll give you an interesting proposition. And it's a case that I had where my client had breast cancer and underwent a double mastectomy. My recollection is about 3 or 4 years before the breakdown of the marriage and their divorcing. And then during the divorcing process, she went and had plastic surgery reconstruction. And when I asked her, why are you having reconstruction now? She said, because I know I'm going to be dating and I know I'm going, hopefully going to marry again. And I think it's important for me in my life going forward. Is that dissipation?
I think that's interesting. It's an interesting argument that could be argued both ways.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. We come across that quite often.
Yeah.
So here's another hypothetical. I buy tickets to the World Series game for my boyfriend. He really wanted the tickets. Is that dissipation?
I think it's dissipation.
If there's any question.
I could see someone arguing that it's not, that it's business development. If the person is in the sports industry or an agent.
Well, how many tickets did she buy? 2?
8.
Oh, she bought 8 tickets. Well,
brought okay. the boyfriend's whole family?
No. She was taking the children.
Her children?
Her children.
Okay.
So what I'm hearing here is 2 excellent lawyers who could argue
either way.
Well, that's the interesting thing about being a lawyer. There is no right or wrong way to argue. And if you're not prepared to argue both sides of the case, you're not a good lawyer.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else that you would like to include on either marital misconduct or dissipation that people listening or viewing this podcast should know?
Sure. For me, don't waste your time on petty issues. If the dissipation that you're looking at or looking to claim is not significant, don't waste your time, your energy, and your money. If it's major and it's worthwhile, your lawyer is going to tell you it's worthwhile pursuing. And if it is, then you pursue it.
Yeah, Candace? I agree with that. If you are milling over bank statements and credit card statements, checking out each time they were at the Starbucks that might be in the boyfriend's building, it's not going to add up enough to be significant, and it will counterbalance what you're paying an attorney's fees.
Okay.
Agreed. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. This isn't the last that you've heard from Candace and James. You will hear from both of them again on a new divorce matter. Thank you very much for listening and for watching. If you like what you see, please share it on your Facebook and your LinkedIn pages. And anytime you can reach out to either James or Candace, or call them or view their bio and learn more about them on www.biermanlaw.com. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Divorce Talk. Visit our website at www.biermanlaw.com, where you can subscribe to the show so you'll never have to miss a single one. Please also follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn and subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating. Be sure to tune in next time for another enlightening episode.